All right, from 5 to whatever time. You don't know where to go.
We sing ta-na-na-na. Platinum sing ta-na-na-na.
Summons a Roman Virgo.
Oh.
Reaching out to have ladies. Friday night, tomorrow night, the place to be. Platinum a call for you, the ladies. Come on.
That's on, boy, yeah. Talk about souls. Talk about doves. Platinum a murder sound, boy, forevermore.
I'm not talking about no loving them because I'm going to murder some sound, boy.
Surprise every gun.
It's not a clash dance.
Believe me when me.
It's just a juggling dance.
Sound, boy, your skull get bored. You don't understand.
I'm out the ear.
Oh, that platinum has a plan. Platinum rise the machine and kill sounds forever. Platinum rise.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is there is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation, and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@cqt.ca or prison@cqt.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You are listening to CQUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial, and www.cqt.ca online.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name's Noah.
And my name is Candace.
And we're your hosts for today's show. On today's show, we'll be featuring words from prisoners who participated in the recently won court case in California. The class action lawsuit transforms California's use of solitary confinement. Today, we'll also be airing an interview with Kilu Nyasha, a longtime activist, former Black Panther, and friend of Hugo Pinnell. Hugo was murdered in prison in California on August 12, 2015. First up, some news items.
As of yesterday, prison officials are still denying Mumia Abu-Jamal all treatment for his recently diagnosed hepatitis C. Mumia is facing charges of $1,000 per pill for treatment. His lawyers are currently fighting for access to treatment. In the meantime, on September 7th, 2015, prison staff boxed up all of his belongings, and his supporters worry that he will face a retaliatory transfer. You can find out more by visiting prisonradio.org.
New York City has announced it will pay nearly $500,000 to settle a civil rights lawsuit filed by 27-year-old Robert Hinton, who was hogtied and beaten by corrections officers at Rikers Island in 2012. Hinton was imprisoned in solitary confinement unit for men with mental illnesses when a beating from corrections officers left him with a broken nose, a fractured vertebra, and a bleeding mouth. His case has already led to the firing of a captain and five officers involved in the beating.
And a federal judge in Texas has issued an unusual order to withdraw the execution date for a man set to die by lethal injection later this month. District Judge David Mendoza ruled Tuesday that Perry Williams should not be put to death on September 29th without a lawyer to handle his appeals. Williams has been without a lawyer since early February. Williams was sentenced to death in 2002 for the murder and robbery of a medical student in Houston. Williams says his gun went off by accident and that his court-appointed lawyer failed to raise evidence that might have spared him a death sentence. Advocates say several more men on death row in Texas are also facing execution without lawyers.
A landmark agreement ends indeterminate long-term solitary confinement in California prisons. In the U.S. federal class action lawsuit Ashker versus Governor of California, a settlement was reached whereby California authorities have agreed to considerably limit the number of prisoners held in isolation for long periods of time. The class action was brought in 2012 by prisoners held in solitary confinement at the Pelican Bay Prison, who each spent more than a decade in the SHU or solitary confinement. The Ashker case argued that California's use of prolonged solitary confinement constitutes cruel and unusual punishment and denies prisoners the right to process. Today on the Prison Radio Show, we hear some of the voices of these men who filed on the class action lawsuit on behalf of all prisoners in the state of California: Gabriel Reyes, George Franco, Jeffrey Franklin, Paul Redd, Sitawa Nantambu, Jemma Newberry, and Todd Ashker. Each have spent more than a decade in solitary confinement, otherwise known as the SHU, at Pelican Bay Prison.
We're gonna make it. being treated like human beings. It's about our Eighth Amendment and 14th Amendment rights. From the deprivation of keeping us from our families and our loved ones, harassing our males, everything, the severe isolation, lack of stimulation, lack of education opportunities, rehabilitative opportunities, lack of decent food, lack of proper medical treatment, lack of just human dignity, being treated like a human being instead of an animal.
I have stress being here. I have stress, not being able to communicate, with my son, the only son I have out there, losing family members. I only see my mom once a year. The ride up here is long, She's old. And dealing with everything here in SHU, I gotta live with this right here every day, Because I feel that, what the lawsuit's about, as far as with the cruel and unusual punishment, and then the due process and all that, being here, why I was put here, for so long and stuff that, why not, I'm living it, Being in SHU is cruel and unusual. It is, we are being punished here, Well, it's like a big old warehouse. I can see if you do something, you pay for your crime, Mm-hmm. You get punished, you go to ATSEG, you do your little SHU term, and get out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But to be put in SHU and to give you a SHU term, and next thing other things come about, validations, and they keep you here, and you're here year after year after year, decade after decade. That's a whole different story right there.
Mm-hmm.
I drove up in 92 and I'm still here. 48 years old. I'm going to be 49 in August, getting old. Health is deteriorating, So it's kind of like, I'm never going to get out of here or what? Yeah, the housing here, mm-hmm. The environment, everything we have to, we have to live here every day. I can't touch my mom, when she comes up. It's a long drive up here, I'm only seeing her once a year for how long? She's already in her 70s. How long is she going to live, Mm-hmm. My dad passed away, my other brothers and sisters passed away, since I've been here. I lost a whole, most, look at that little list I gave you. Mostly everybody passed away, So it's kind of like everybody passing away. And I'm only seeing my mom once a year, so if someone else passes away, who's going to bring her up to see me,
mm-hmm.
And I only get to talk to her, through a phone behind the glass, I can't touch her, I can't hug her, I wasn't there for her, when my dad passed away, brothers and sisters, my son, the only son I got, mm-hmm. can't even, I can't even write him, can't even talk to him on the phone,
mm-hmm.
That's my blood right there. That's all I left.
Being subjected to long-term sensory deprivation, I've been removed from nature and life. Exactly what I'm saying is life. I don't see what's all around me. I'm not able to interact outside the little area I'm in, that pod. It's all results from that. If I'm not able to hear voices to talk to my family, not able to be transferred to be closer to my family or to be transferred to a prison where I'm able to see things around me, whether it's trees, grass, birds, other people. I'm not able to go out to a yard and be with other people to get sunlight. Like I said, I feel kept away from nature and life. Kept away from being able to interact with, hear my family, talk to my family. I have grandchildren, so I'm not able to hear their voice and be a part of their life. So it's like, with that, I can't get out of here, out of the hole, and not getting out the hole, man. I don't see me going through the board, getting a date. So it's like, pretty much, in my mind, I try to fight it, the fact of I might have to die in here. How do I prepare for that?
You become to the point where you feel that, you know, that everything around you becomes numb sometimes. You just, you numb up. You try to, you know, close your feelings off where you don't try to feel nothing. You feel like there's no hope. Well, I'm hoping that the conditions change back here in this shoe. I'm hoping, I like to hope that this shoe is shut down. I don't think no human being should have to live in this shoe, especially as long as we have lived in this shoe.
Sitawa, Natambu, Jamal. You know, right there we're talking about Africans. To have a common dialogue with another African, when you start isolating, intentionally isolating groups of people, these are part of the results of cultural deprivation, sensory deprivation. It always plays a role in one mental state. You know, being in an environment like this is it mentally wear on you, and is destructive in and of itself of the confinement, you know. And most times, in any behavior modification unit, you always have the environment, structural environment that kicks in first. And then it started weighing on the minds of the individual, to which I speak to right there. And that's a general and a simplistic application of what goes on in the type of environment that you know you are the target, and every prisoner in here is a target in this kind of structural environment as for behavior modification.
You are listening to the voices of some of the prisoners who filed a class action lawsuit as part of a mass movement against solitary confinement. There are approximately 80,000 prisoners in solitary confinement in the United States alone. We also heard some music in there. We heard Concrete Cell by Rusted Dawn and We Are the Prisoners by The Kids.
I'm not talking about screaming like, oh. I'm talking about if you could put every emotion of the human spirit, of hopelessness, pain, agony, hatred, all these emotions, frustration, while you're locked in this cage, treated like some animal.
This is a behavior modification, psychological, low-intensity warfare against the mind of a human being. That's what exists here at Pelican Bay.
It's not to the point where you want to commit suicide, but sometimes I'll be at the point that I'll be wanting to write the judge, say, just give me the death penalty. Just give me the death penalty, man.
At the time the case was filed, in 2012, more than 500 prisoners were being isolated in the SHU, or Security Housing Unit, at Pelican Bay for over 10 years. 80 had been there for more than 20 years. People in solitary spend 22 to 24 hours a day in a cramped, concrete, windowless cell and are denied telephone calls, physical contact with visitors, and vocational, recreational, and educational programming. Thousands of prisoners everywhere are being held in similar SHU conditions. In 2009, they began organizing a hunger strike to draw attention to their situation. In 2013, more than 30,000 prisoners participated in another 60-day hunger strike, believed to be the largest prison hunger strike in history.
And then the four of us from different races or geographic areas of the state of California, we volunteered to become the four main representatives of this short quarter collective.
To prisoners in California have entered their fifth day of a hunger strike in a push to end long-term solitary confinement, which they call a form of indefinite state-sanctioned torture.
I'm certain that the purpose was because when I was in that pod, I was with other prisoners who we're the ones who formed what was known as the Pelican Bay Shoe Short Corridor Collective, which was a prisoner class human rights movement seeking to expose the torture of long-term decades housed in a shoe. And, you know, it was well known that I was one of the main catalysts for the creation of that group, and all the writings that were put out in public describing our complaints and in order to educate the public and other prisoners about what's really been going on in this California system in these shoe units for close to 30 years. And so that was an opportunity for IGI and probably the administration to separate me from the other main representatives in this coalition. Number one, the cell that they put me in D4, when they first put me over there in September of 2012, had a Lexan covering, which is a plexiglass covering over the entire front of the cell. And that makes it a lot harder to communicate even with other prisoners or staff in the pod. It restricts airflow. It's either real super hot or real cold. And it's a lot more isolation and sensory deprivation. And then through our, at that time we were having monthly meetings with the administration here. At the time it was Associate Warden P.T. Smith. He was in charge of SHU, and we had complained about the Lexan covering on these cells because of various factors that I just touched on. And so in December of 2012, he had the Lexan covers removed from the F-pods throughout the entire D facility of SHU because of those complaints. And, you know, recently, just like on October 31st, that Lexan was placed back on the front of our F-pod cells. But in response to your question, you know, this disrupted my ability to work with and communicate with the other main representatives involved in our collective prisoner human rights movement. And that was the purpose. See, what happened was there was four of us who, well, there was the guys in our pod in D1. We all talked and we came up with, decided to create this collective, right? The group of us there, and then there was other people in the pod next door, right, who we could talk to through the, by listening, putting our ear up against the yard door, right? The yard door joins the two yards, okay? And we're the ones, and then the four of us from different races or geographic areas of the state of California, we volunteered to become the four main representatives of this Short Corridor Collective. As far as I know, it's like I said, communication's been disrupted, but as far as I know, the main representatives are myself, Frankel, Arturo Castellanos, and Sitawa Dewberry. It's pretty small. I mean, I've never measured it. I've read stuff where it described it as like 80 square feet and like 8 foot high walls. You know, you have the two cement bunks. You have a cement desk area and a cement stool area. You have a combination stainless steel sink toilet thing. And you have three three walls, and then the front of the cell is metal with perforated holes. And like I was saying, on my cell, it's got that whole area is covered with Lexan now. You have a fluorescent light, and you have the vent. You know, that's pretty much the cell right there. Yeah, they have a designated area that you can put stuff on the wall, right? At the foot of your bed, that area of the cement, right? But since we filed this class action lawsuit, as it's kind of gained traction, you know, I put stuff on more areas of that same wall, and nobody said anything about it, right? Maybe May, June, it'd been a while, and I was like, and when I got at him in April with that birthday card, I sent him a picture too, because my niece, she'd sent me a photo of her and her kids and her boyfriend, and he's never met them or anything, and I figured, well, for his birthday, he'd like to see one of his grandkids and great-grandkids. And he, according to him, he never got hurt, never received that. And this is an issue. I mean, if you think about it, I've been in SHU now for 28.3 years. And, you know, that's not enough, being kept in a cell 24 hours a day. You have these things going on with the mail on a fairly regular, ongoing basis. I don't know if you could imagine it, having never experienced that, of the psychological, the mental stress and emotions that might cause you to feel when you have these family members and friends that are your only line to the outside world, and they're being stressed out, and you're being stressed out, and frustrated and angry, and you're looking at these guards coming to your cell, and your mail's being played with, and you don't know who it is. Over time, it's a pretty serious issue. You know, things where your mail gets handed to somebody else on the tier. You know, all these kind of things are problems. It's all part of the process of tormenting prisoners and breaking them down. In my view, it's all intended to coerce a person to become a state informant through the debriefing process. You know, the prison system is just, you probably know, but just to hear it from me, a prison system is a microcosm of society, okay? In society, you have drama, you have politics, you have crime, you have across the board. Prison system is a microcosm of that. But you have, the difference is you have a bunch of convicted felons, right, who a majority of which come from the working class poor communities, had a hard life, probably involved in drugs, right, and you have them all grouped up. A lot of them were involved in, grew up from little kids, maybe through their whole families, their grandfathers, fathers, mothers, cousins, all in street gangs. They were brought up in that environment from the time they were little kids, right? And then they're put in this prison, right, where they don't have any, they're stuck. Out in society, if you have a problem with somebody or there's, you know, you have a choice. You can distance yourself from it. In prison, you can't. Well, you can if you go to the guards and say, hey, you need to protect me or get me out of here. you know, but if you do that, you know, they own your ass for the rest of your life, and you're gonna have a hard road to go if you go that way, right? So naturally there's gonna be conflict, right? That's just human nature. That's why I don't, you know, as far as politics, disruption, I mean, it depends. And what is this guy, what evidence do you have, right? Is because a guy is labeled as a gang member, does that mean that if something happens with the group that he's involved with on that line, he should automatically be snatched up off that main line and put in a cell, in a box, for 24/7 for decades? No. I think there's a lot better, more humane, smarter ways of dealing with even the most, say you have a documented history of a prisoner who is a, you know, could be viewed as a vicious, predatory prisoner, right? Is it right to put that guy, because he did things 30 years ago, right, in a box for 30 years, right? No. There's other ways to deal with it. Other countries have proven that there is more humane, smarter ways of dealing with. You take that guy who knows what the circumstances were to what he might have done, right? Say he killed some cops, some guards, right? Who knows what them guards were doing? Say those guards were trying to set him up to be murdered by other prisoners for whatever reason. And he said, you know what? You want to have me murdered by these other prisoners? I'm going to murder you. How's that? Right? And then you take that guy and you put him in a box and you treat him like he's some kind of subhuman animal for 30 years. You know what? You think that's making that person better? You think that's making everybody safer? Right? This is still a human being. You know, in our society was based on, it was originated on, we believe that human beings can be redeemed. They're redeemable. Our system of incarceration was created to punish a prisoner and correct him or make him a better person than when he went in there.
That was Todd Ashker from Pelican Bay Prison, an organizer against solitary confinement. That was an excerpt from the legal deposition in the class action lawsuit for which a settlement was reached on September 1st. The agreement ends indeterminate solitary confinement, moves out of SHU all of those who've been there 10 years or longer. The agreement ends solitary based only on gang affiliation, and creates a modified general population unit for certain prisoners as a new alternative to solitary confinement. The settlement represents a victory for prisoners towards the goals of ending solitary confinement and abolishing prisons altogether. You are listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Pop Montreal hosts the Montreal Session every Tuesdays throughout the month of September. What better way to plan out your pop itinerary than to tune into 90.3 FM, Tuesdays 3 to 5 p.m., and get the full download from those in the know. The Pop Montreal staff will be hosting the sessions, and listeners can expect to hear an on-air interviews, live performances, artists and showcase profiles, and pop picks and reviews straight from the source. That's every Tuesdays in September on CKUT 90.3 FM from 3 to 5 p.m., or catch you on the archives anytime at ckut.ca.
And 2013, an unlikely coalition of indigenous land defenders and Acadian and Anglo settlers kicked out fracking company SWN from Mi'kmaq territories in so-called New Brunswick. Join us to learn how this movement won against powerful political and business interests with presentations by Mi'kmaq land defender Annie Clare from Elsibuktuk and journalist Miles Howe of the Halifax Media Co-op and author of Debriefing Elsibuktuk. Also, we will screen a selection of short films about indigenous resistance by submedia.tv. The event takes place on Friday, September 11th at 5 p.m. at Concordia University, 1515 St. Catherine West, room EV1605. The event is free. Visit submedia.tv for details. And this is a CKUT co-presentation.
The time is presently 5:38, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
Up next is an interview with Kilu Niasha about Hugo Pinel. Kilu is a longtime activist, former Black Panther, and producer of the television show Freedom is a Constant Struggle. She's also an internationalist and a longtime friend of Hugo Pinel. In the interview, Kilu talks about the original charges that Hugo faced in 1964. She talks about Hugo's revolutionary organizing in the prisons in California. She mentions the Agreement to End All Hostilities, which happened when representatives of the California hunger strike issued a statement on August 12, 2012, calling for an end to all violence and hostility between different groups of prisoners throughout the state of California, from maximum security prisons to county jails. Kilu also talks about the San Quentin Six, who are six prisoners, including Hugo Pinel, who were charged with participating in an August 21, 1971 escape attempt that ended with six people dead, including George Jackson, who was murdered by prison guards. Toward the end of the interview, Kilu reads excerpts from letters she received from Hugo.
Okay, I'm Kilu Niasha. I'm a longtime activist, former Panther, and producer of Freedom is a Constant Struggle, a local community television show that is aired bi-monthly. And I've been a long-time struggler for the release of political prisoners, as well as a journalist and a news junkie. And I've written for the Bayview newspaper, among other periodicals, and am struggling to make revolution. That pretty much sums me up. Amazing. I'm an internationalist, by the way.
Okay. So today we're going to be talking about Hugo Pinel, who was also known as Yogi to many people. And he was murdered in New Folsom Prison in California on August 12, 2015. Can you explain who Yogi is for folks who might not have heard of him before, and how did you and Yogi know each other?
Right. Hugo Pinel, English speakers say Hugo, but it's actually Hugo in Spanish. Lion Antonio Pinel was born in Nicaragua, and his mother left Nicaragua with him and emigrated to the States. When he was 12 years old, and I can't think of the year offhand, but he was 71 when they killed him last month. And he, she had to work as a single mom to survive with her kid, her children. And she worked in a factory, and of course, that kind of left Yogi, you know, a latchkey kid like most of our kids were in those days when we're struggling to work full-time jobs and trying to keep up with him. And I'll say it in his own words. When I was in the streets, in and out of youth authority institutions, I was so caught up in the streets environment that mom and grandma couldn't do a thing with me. And I didn't smoke, no drugs, and only drank twice, 62, 64, and both times I got in trouble. And mom, grandma, and I were tight all the way from the old country. Lots of love, but my behavior got foul, rebellious. At 15 and in those streets, even guys in the streets went on my, because you're a square, don't know what's happened. You shouldn't be out here. If you don't want to go back to school, get you a job and get off these streets. unquote. But I was caught up, and it really hurt me to see Mom and Grandma so worried about me. They couldn't understand what was going on with me, and neither did I. I just had to be on the streets, acting up, no self-control, not much care. When I hit that lady in 64, I felt so bad for her, for my mom and grandma, even for me. I was feeling shame and so angry with myself, I had to turn myself in for various reasons. So I'll stop there. So that he's talking about the 1964 incident. He was also led by old relatives, I think an uncle and somebody, on this assault on a young woman at the time. And unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation about that. But Yogi, as you just heard, and there were other letters where he talks about it again, and how much remorse he really feels for that. And no one is the sum total of his or her worst mistake. And that happened when he was 19, and in 1967, he was transformed by the from the influence of W.L. Nolan and George Jackson, Howard Toll, and others, but especially W.L. Nolan, because he had known Nolan in juvenile and other prisons and stuff, and he knew him to be a gangster and a real funky fighter. He was known as the Marvin Hagler of the prison system, and who was a middleweight champion at one time. So the bottom line is he became a revolutionary, and those brothers transformed the gangster mentality into a revolutionary mentality, whereby instead of being predators, and when they went back to the streets, they would be servants of the people when they got out, and servants of the people while they were in, and they became unifiers. They began to organize inside the walls to bring prisoners together to stop end the hostilities. And fast forward to August 2012, right about the time of the hunger strike. The hunger strike, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, began in 2011. By 2012, in the short corridor of Pelican Bay, SHU, Security Housing Unit, which is a monster place. It's completely windowless. Only has doors. I've been up there, and it just looks like a concrete tomb. And so those prisoners are locked 24/7, except if they're permitted to go to what they euphemistically call the yard, because it's nothing but a concrete closet with a plexiglass over. It's outdoors, but it's still, you're still isolated. So they came up with an end to hostilities, an agreement to end hostilities on August 12th. 2012. 3 years later, August 12th, 2015, we strongly believe Hugo Pinel was set up to be murdered on the yard of Folsom. They knew Folsom was dangerous. Other brothers who know people there and have been there testify that it is one of the more dangerous yards in the prison system. So they knew exactly what they were doing from the time they whisked him out of the Pelican Bay SHU in 2014. Just before the New York Times journalists were allowed into the SHU to interview the hunger strikers, so they made sure they didn't interview a member of the San Quentin Six who's famous. So, or infamous, as his enemies like to say. So we're convinced that they were setting him up to be murdered.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit. How did you and Hugo get to know each other? I know you guys have been corresponding were corresponding for a really long time.
Oh, yes, yes. I started writing George Jackson when I was in New Haven working for the lawyers, and one of them was Charles Garry, and, of course, as His firm is in San Francisco, and he's in close touch with, George's lawyers. And so I sat down, and after reading Soledad Brother, I sat down and wrote a long letter, a typewritten letter to George about the book, and sent it to him through the lawyers. And he responded so promptly and great length that I was floored, because his Soledad Brother was a bestseller, and I didn't even think I thought I might not even get an answer. He was so famous at the time. But he and I started an intense correspondence, and by the time I got out here, he was passing me around to other brothers. They did that a lot in those days, write her, she'll write you back kind of thing. And so eventually I wound up writing to almost all the brothers. And then in 1973, I got a letter from Yogi that I still have. Oh, I went through my list and I found that one. And I lost touch with him because I became seriously ill. I had to leave to go back to back east. I was having a lot of personal problems, and I was struggling to become a martial artist and overworking my muscles, and wound up with quote unquote many inflamed muscles, which is what polymyositis translates medically into. So my illness kept me in and out of hospitals between 75 and 80. So I lost touch. I wasn't able to support the six during their trials and stuff. So when I got out, I found Yogi was Foggy again in 1990 in Pelican Bay, and we really began an intense correspondence, and I've written to him ever since. I have stacks and stacks of letters from him, and I want to share a few excerpts from some of them if we have time. But suffice it to say, it was not just the 183. Yogi kept me going. I mean, I was having a really hard time struggling to raise my child here in the Ping Yun projects in Chinatown and as a disabled woman, and it wasn't easy. And he was such inspiration and such motivation for me to keep going and keep struggling that I don't know what I'm going to do without him.
I've read in different places that Hugo was in solitary confinement for a really long time, and you mentioned wanting to talk about some of the conditions that he faced inside. Do you want to talk a bit about that now?
Sure. First of all, it should be known that when he was out of, when he was on the main lines and stuff, you know, he was, and even when he was caught up in the in the lockups and isolated in solitary confinement, I mean, he was subjected to real funky beatings. Because for one thing, he was one of the soldiers who would really stand up for the brothers. Yogi didn't even have to know someone. If they were being brutalized by one of the guards or something, and he was in the vicinity, they couldn't do it in front of him because he would jump in and help defend the brother. So he was in constant trouble. I remember him writing a letter one time and telling me, Cleve Edwards, the one who was shot and killed on the yard with W.L. Nolan and Alan Miller, they called him Sweet Jugs Miller, and left to bleed to death. Before they killed Cleve, Yogi said in a letter that Cleve was thrown in the hole and he had to catch a case or something to go see about him. He had to get thrown in the hole himself to go see about him. I mean, who does that? The brother, and, you know, just by the way, since his death, I've never seen so many grown men, you know, strong, you know, men, grown men cry, shed real tears. You know, Yogi was really, really loved. And if people should read Min Yi's book, The Melancholy History of Soledad. And in it, Yogi was referred to by the other brothers as the general, because he was really, as David said, the heart and spirit of the struggle inside, whereas George was the strategist and the he was more the ideologist, if that's a word.
I read the transcript of your talk with Terry Collins in the San Francisco Bay View, and you talked about how Hugo taught you to stop saying free all political prisoners, which I think is still a big thing a lot of people on the outside say. Do you want to talk a bit more about this? And then maybe we could read some excerpts, or you could read some excerpts from Hugo's letters if you'd like.
Yes. Yes. Yogi said to me one time, you know, they can't free me. I'm already free. They can just release me. Okay? So I didn't make that mistake again. I also wanted to mention how he cared so much about others and stuff. Here's an excerpt from a letter dated May 2nd, 2013. Don't know if I ever told you that in September 1969, when they locked me up, I was close to going home, but there was an incident, and of course I was among the ones locked up for investigation. Some of the other brothers locked up, Brother Howard, Christmas, Little John, and Whiteside, there was no investigation. In October 69, Howard and Christmas, two of my main teachers and brothers, and Little John were moved to the AC in San Quentin. That's another solitary confinement. And Whiteside and I were moved to Max Row, D Wing, in Soledad, where W.L. and two other brothers had been going through a nightmare. Within 2 years, W.L., Sweet Jugs, Young Cleve, Jonas, Christmas, James Billingsley, James, he means William Christmas, he means Jonathan, he means James McLean, Fred Billingsley, and George Jackson, would be physically gone. Bang. One of the human stories connected ever strongly and vividly to those still alive from those times and with those brothers. One of the human stories connected ever strongly and growing to live within and keep those energies alive. So I know all of those living energies are with us in this run, and being together holds great meaning and significance. In other words, he believes in those living, the people who have been martyred, our martyrs, live in his heart and soul, and he keeps those living energies within him so that they sustain him. And then he closes with, please give Lynn, he's referring to Lynn Stewart, more love, who was incarcerated at the time, like you're doing for me. I might not get released, but the loving company, care, and support means more than words can express. So we give all of that to Lynn with a big kiss on her lips and a thank you, Lynn, and a quote-unquote thank you, Lynn. Take much care. And then he says, I'm rooting for the Spurs. Yeah. But, okay, here's another. You're so right. Love has been the main power that has kept me growing, more human, alive, and determined to live freely. For that's what this push, struggle, and living is all about, freedom. It cannot, and then I'm skipping, it cannot be ever taken away again, not even in death. And then over here is another one. It says, we're better off working within ourselves and with what we're able to control. We cannot control who and what's outside of ourselves. This is when he was giving me some advice on some personal problems. So I left the personal problems out, but this is good advice for everyone. We can wish everyone the best, hope they are doing constructive work, being part of the solution, But we must keep working, growing, moving forward, and living in that freedom space we have created from and through our constant struggles. And then, let's see. For W.L., Malcolm was our principal example of true change, transformation, that new man. Malcolm began his transformation in prison, and he was seriously dedicated. Then he went to the streets and continued to grow and grow. And I know that in that growth, he was achieving a personal freedom of which he craved more and more. W.L. said that as youngsters, we're crazy bad, messing up, and we could sell excuses because most were doing it. And we had no true examples outside of our moms and dads. But once grown and finding true examples, new ways, new schools, and materials, no more excuses and failures are as much personal. No more excuses and failures are as much personal as the human riches we achieve through constant work and growth. Oh. This I took this out. Now I'll close with this one. This one's dated December 29th, 2014. He gets right to it. I heard the news of Mumia's daughter passing, and it hurts so much. To know we can be hurt in so many ways because of the positions imposed upon us when placed in those infested, impossible-to-live-in ghettos, given a key and, okay, you are in this free society with the chance to live the American dream. Be grateful for your emancipation. Never really had a chance, did we, sis? Most of the few who survived and gained some stability in this rotten apple turned away, and some turned against us. We have suffered so much and so many tragedies, hence our struggle, and we find it created in our hearts of hearts that magnificent, beautiful space which enable us to carry on for all.